our cash position, and we show you our share count. So people can calculate exactly, you know, how many pounds did we buy that day. And we also provide these charts so people can look at over time what our buying activity looks like on both a daily basis and a cumulative basis. I've been amazed at how closely scrutinized and watched we are by investors around the world. There's people on Twitter that literally update spreadsheets every night and share them with the group so that people have the most up-to-date information around what the trust is doing. You know, that has caused us to be a bit more cautious around what we're doing and as WMC suggested. But, you know, the goal of the trust is to be as fully invested as possible. We generally are 96 to 98% invested in physical uranium at all times. The cash will deviate, you know, a couple of percent here or there, depending on inflows and depending on availability of material in the spot market. We've purchased uranium from over 20 different parties so far. I think that's really unique. We had a very open approach. We basically are looking at the best offers that we can find around the world from all market participants, whether you're a producer, a utility, a junior uranium company that wants to sell us, investment funds. We've cleaned out a lot of pounds that investment funds had previously bought and stored them directly because they recognized the vehicle was a better solution for them. So I think this buying approach that we have is the most shareholder friendly in terms of looking for the best offers we can find around the world. Okay, let's move to the next slide, please. Okay, so on the left side of the chart here, this is global electricity production by source. And when I first learned about this, I was a bit surprised. And what I was surprised about was that 38% of the world's electricity is still produced by coal. And this is one of the areas that governments around the world are trying to address, meaning trying to reduce. China, for example, 10 years ago, over 70% of their electricity production came from coal. Right now they're down to 55%, and they want to keep moving that number lower and lower and lower. And they're doing that obviously by building more nuclear power plants and shifting to more renewables. Nuclear, you can see there, accounts for just 10% of global electricity production, but it represents more than 50% of the zero carbon emissions from electricity production. So it's very important. Hydro, 16%, solar, wind, geothermal, tide about 7%, oil 3%, and other 3% that's mostly biomass. Now, you know, nuclear being 10% of the world's electricity is a pretty substantial number. But when you look at the next chart, what we looked at was the market capitalization of all the uranium miners that we could find that are publicly listed. So there are about 80 companies. And if you take the market cap of all 80, the combined market cap is about $33 billion US, okay? If you compare that to some of the oil and gas companies, which obviously are very important because of the transportation, less so for you know, electricity production, but you know, natural gas obviously is a key commodity for heating and whatnot. But if you take a look at the market cap of just some of these select oil and gas companies, I mean, take a look at Exxon, for example. The market cap of Exxon is 10 times the value of all 80 uranium companies. These are producers, developers, exploration companies. But let's go down the food chain a little bit and just look at EOG Resources. The market cap of that company alone is 2 times the 80 uranium companies. So I highlight this because it just is a really good illustration of how small the uranium sector is on a market cap basis, and how it is hard for institutions to get involved in this sector. You know, and some people have said to me, you know, am I too late? If I miss this, is this now a crowded trade? And my answer is no, it's just getting started. And the big institutional money is still trying to figure out how to even get involved. So I still think there's lots of opportunity ahead of us. This number in terms of the market capitalization of uranium miners obviously has to get substantially higher over time, because if it doesn't get higher, we won't be able to supply the world with the uranium required. They won't be able to bring their projects online to meet the future needs of the nuclear power fleet. Okay, and I'm going to wrap up with one last slide, just summarizing why invest in uranium. I'm not going to go through this in great detail, but I do believe that there is a major shift in sentiment, investor sentiment, government policy and sentiment. Non-utility buyers are coming back into the market and adding a very different dimension to a market that historically has been dormant. And this constrained supply is real. It will take many years for new projects to come online and meet some of the needs of the future. And with that, I'm just going to close with the next slide, which is if you'd like to learn more and you'd like to contact us, we are available all the time and very responsive. If you go to sprott.com/uranium, that's our webpage that houses all of our content on the trust and education about the sector. You can email us at uranium@sprott.com. And for anyone in North America, we have a 1-800 number. And then finally, @Sprott is our Twitter handle. And we're pretty active in terms of tweeting out news about the sector and the trust. So thank you very much for allowing me to participate in the event. And I hope you find the rest of the day very useful.
John, thank you much, very much. Really appreciate that presentation. Can learn more about Sprott and all of our exhibiting presenters in the expo hall later on. I'm joined now by Spencer Abraham, the CEO and chairman of the Abraham Group, former U.S. Secretary of Energy, and former U.S. Senator from Michigan. Thanks very much for joining us. I suspect there are many demands on your time right now, so I appreciate it. I last saw you in person 2017 at the Sprott Symposium in Vancouver. My question was, a lot of things have happened since then. What stands out in your mind?
Well, obviously, there's a lot going on. And, you know, I think it's kind of, you know, important to look at what's going on right now. I mean, the issues between Russia and Ukraine, they've once again, I think, brought the issues of energy security and international energy challenges into focus. And, you know, I think we've seen again in just the last few weeks, the degree to which the United States at least needs to develop its own independent supply chain, whether it's in the area of nuclear energy or it's in others, oil and gas and so on, because we now realize that all you need is a conflagration such as has happened in Europe to potentially cut off sources and so on, and really make it all the more important for America to be as energy independent as it can. And you know, we've also seen what you know can happen to the energy markets in terms of prices when something transforms them overnight. And so I think that's kind of the current issue of the day, and it obviously has a big impact in the nuclear sector, particularly as it relates to the supply chain, with uranium being a central element there.
Mr. Secretary, I didn't bring you on here specifically to complain about the price of energy in the U.S., but I have to say, where I live in California, gasoline is over $6 per gallon now, where we live here. And the way I look at sampling gas prices in California, it's kind of like rectal thermometry. It's unpleasant. It's the highest number. But at times, I think it's most indicative of problems brewing. What obviously recent factors have weighed into this a lot, but what other factors would you say, things that perhaps we could control, have contributed to our current situation?
Well, I think you know the recent events have certainly had an impact, but this began long before Russia decided to invade Ukraine. And it has to do with the general philosophy and approach of Washington, at least on the domestic front, towards the energy sector. When the Biden administration had obviously stopped the Keystone pipeline, it began putting very significant constraints on issuing permits for drilling on federal lands, and while some of this is obviously takes time to have an impact, The fact is that when the investment community recognizes that the next 4 years are going to be largely devoted towards constraining the energy sector, then it's going to move investment elsewhere. It's going to cause companies to pull back on their capital expenditures if they're in the oil and gas business. And all of that started happening, you know, pretty much day one or week one or certainly month one of the Biden administration. And then, you know, after a few months, all of those actions start to have an impact. We were coming out of, you know, the initial round of COVID. There was beginning to be a resurgence in the economy, but this put a real damper, I think, on, you know, the oil and gas sector. And when that started to happen, then you had less investment. You had demand growing, but you didn't have, you know, supply able to meet it. And then on a global basis, similar things were going on the market. And so the prices started to climb up. It's no accident where we're at today, because the combination of those policies and now the lighting of the fuse that transpired when Russia made its, you know, invasion decision, combined to put your gas at $6 a gallon and climbing.
So you mentioned the Biden administration. We recently saw them add energy, oil and gas to the list of Russia sanctions. Kind of, you know, volume wise, not a really big number, right? 3% is what I understand the imports are, maybe 8 if you add refined product. What do you think was the reasoning behind adding oil and gas to the list of Russia sanctions?
Well, I think that the, you know, they wanted to send a signal that the United States and its consumers and its economy were not going to subsidize this war. And so by putting that ban in place, I think they're sending a signal that America is not going to be sending, you know, its resources, its financial resources to Russia so they can bankroll aggression. I am disappointed that so far they haven't done the same with regard to uranium imports, which of course constitute from Russia, which constitute a very substantial amount of the uranium components that are used in the powering of America's nuclear fleet. And just this week, Senator Barrasso of Wyoming has introduced legislation that would also ban imports of uranium from Russia. And I think that's a very positive step in terms of sending the right signals to the Russians about how we feel with respect to their aggression.
In his meeting recently, Jerome Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, was asked this question, and I want to put a similar question to you. He was asked, in what's going on now with Russia and also sanctions, banking sanctions and whatnot. The question was, what role does he play? What role does the Fed play? Is it strictly technical, or are they involved in actually the decision whether or not those sanctions should take place? I'm wondering, what does the current energy secretary, what role does she play in the response to the geopolitical unrest, particularly when we're talking about energy sanctions? Is it purely technical, or does she have some input on whether or not this should go forward?
Well, I can't answer specifically, because I think between one administration and the next one, the Secretary of Energy has varying degrees of involvement in policymaking. I'm sure that she and her department have been consulted regularly with regard to the impact on oil and prices of putting a ban in place, because the Energy Department houses the Energy Information Administration, which is the real, you know, sort of assessment office of the U.S. in terms of, anything related to energy calculations. As to whether she advised on that policy specifically, I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll just have to wait and see whether she comments about her role herself. It's not the kind of thing in most cases that an administration would be specific about. I mean, they typically keep their own counsel as to who are the people in the room when certain decisions are made. But I would think as Energy Secretary, she's probably been part of that decision.
It's been a while since your time as Energy Secretary, and like I mentioned in the opening, a lot has happened certainly since that time. But in your view, what is the biggest difference in U.S. energy policy between your time, which ended, I believe, in 2005, and today?
Well, let's talk about it in two dimensions. In one dimension, where does the United States stand in terms of domestic resources? And as I was coming to the end of my tenure, we were just beginning to appreciate the potential magnitude of oil and natural gas reserves that we had that could be tapped through hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling and so on. And it was in the next 2 years after I left the job that companies really began to successfully extract large amounts of oil and natural gas, which we continue to do today. And that change was dramatic because it has given the United States the potential to be energy independent, the potential to really control its own destiny, so to speak, with regard to a number of minerals. So that's a big change, and that's kind of a macro change. I think on a more micro level, the difference would be that in the Bush administration where I served, we viewed developing an all of the above energy strategy as critical to America's energy security. And so we were striving to encourage the development of more nuclear power as part of our energy sources. We were trying to, develop oil and natural gas as well as renewables, solar and wind. And so we wanted to really, have a wide variety of energy sources. And so we were encouraging development across the board. I think in the current administration, and this is a big difference, almost all of the, focus is on developing things like electric vehicles or clean energy technologies. And I am no opponent of that. I think, it's great because, for instance, nuclear power is the largest clean, energy source we have in the United States, and we need to have more, not fewer, nuclear power plants. But that shouldn't mean that we also, just shut the door on other things. And where this comes into play can be seen right now in this whole European conflict. As the United States becomes more energy rich, it's in a position to provide more energy security to the globe, which means that we have begun to export natural gas through LNG terminals to address other countries' lack of resources. And if we had done more of that, or Europe had been more receptive to it, it wouldn't be as dependent on Russia for its natural gas support. The same with oil. When I was Energy Secretary, it was we wouldn't have thought of a day in which the U.S. could export oil, and yet, now we are able to do that if we're allowed to robustly pursue oil development in the United States. So that's, I think, an example of both the large global as well as domestic changes over the last 15 years.
I think the last couple of weeks have certainly been quite extraordinary. I think it has many people scratching their heads and maybe, as you suggest, questioning policy of the past, decisions they made. At one point, it looked like we wouldn't need Saudi oil. Now it feels like it would be nice to have some of that now. I think the decisions that the Europeans made about baseload power is perhaps being called into question, and investors all around the world are questioning the price that they put on risk, whether or not that was appropriate or not. So all of these things now, I believe, will change things going forward. But what, in your opinion, are the long-run repercussions of the situation in Ukraine, specifically for energy imports and exports for the U.S.?
Well, I think I hope the implications will be that the United States commits to developing our domestic oil, gas, and other resources so that we can be an exporter and provide countries in Europe and elsewhere an option to getting all of their energy from places that are less stable or dependable, like Russia. And I'd be one of the transitions we see. At the same time, I hope we recognize, by watching Russia's actions in Ukraine, but also as it's used its gas as a political tool, that we'll recognize that we should not be at the mercy of Russia with regard to energy imports. And we certainly are with regard to the imports of nuclear fuel for our power plants and the uranium that is, you know, the basis of the nuclear fuel. So I hope that it will also lead to policies that allow us to develop more of those resources domestically so that we're not at the mercy of other countries' export policies, because those could change overnight and put the United States at a real disadvantage.
Mr. Secretary, I know you have to go soon, but I'm hoping to slip in one last question. As households sort of struggle to make ends meet with rising fuel prices and inflation, not just in fuel, inflation everywhere, I'm wondering, what do you feel is the higher priority here, the cost advantages that we enjoy through a global energy market, or the security and sustainability of a more secure U.S.-centric policy?
Well, you know, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, first of all. And I think developing more, you know, domestic capabilities is definitely a national security issue that has to take, you know, precedence in a certain sense. But I don't think you can, you know, that in doing that, you know, we should be doing it exclusively for the benefit of using all of the energy we develop ourselves. I think we should be thinking of it as a way for the United States to have both its own energy security, because we're producing more at home, and help provide security to our friends around the world. That's where I think we can and should be. And policies that ignore that, and we've had some of them, I think, in the last year, I think those kinds of policies, you know, both disrupt the global market on the one hand and create more dependence on the other hand. It's fine to say, we'll have electric vehicles everywhere by 2030 or 2040 or whatever, and maybe we will. And, you know, I'm not opposed to that. They'll need electricity, and we'll need to provide that electricity. You know, what we can't lose sight of is that between now and whenever that magic date is, we still have to run, you know, our businesses and our factories and our homes and so on. And we better be able to do that at an affordable price, or, as you know, you're learning where you live, you know, the family budget will be undermined because we haven't put enough focus and faith in our own capabilities.
All right. That's all the time we have. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for joining us. Once again, appreciate it. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Look forward to it. Thanks a lot.
All right, that was former U.S. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham. We're back now. I'm going to ask Rick Rule to join us, and joining him will be Amir Adnani, President, CEO, and Director of Uranium Energy Corp. Gentlemen, take it away.
Thank you, Albert. Amir, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Doesn't sound like you can hear me. Test, Amir?
Okay, I'm having trouble getting Amir's audio right now. Rick, what did you think about Spencer's talk?
Well, I think both prior talks were spectacular. John Champaglia with the market overview around uranium, I think followed on very nicely to the WMC talk. And of course, you know, former Secretary Abraham has a wonderful sense of energy markets generally. I would like to have heard him discuss more about the politics of uranium specifically, but I can understand how that's sort of a touchy topic for him right now. But I think his point, which is to say that increasing U.S. energy capabilities is a friendly rather than an unfriendly act in the global context and is absolutely necessary with regards to domestic policies, is important.
Okay, I think we have Amir Adnani with you now.
Amir, are you back with us?
I am back. How are you, Steve?
Yeah, he's there. Go ahead, Rick. He can hear you.
Amir, can you hear me?
He can hear you. You can't hear him right now.
Go ahead, Rick.
Ask your question.
Amir, I'm sorry. I can't hear whether you're with us or not, but I'm going to ask you some questions, and you can answer on behalf of the crowd. What I'd like you to do to begin with is give us a brief overview of UEC, Uranium Energy Corp., and about your strategy, a strategy which you've focused on since the beginning of the company, of U.S. uranium production rather than global uranium production. So tell us something about the company and tell us why you decided, even as a non-American, as a Canadian, to focus on U.S. uranium production.
About 18 years ago, when I looked at the uranium landscape globally, I saw even back then that there was 90% of uranium requirements in the U.S. were being imported, 90%. Today, that dependency on foreign uranium has gotten to the point of no return. It's 100% dependency on foreign uranium. And primarily, the largest supplier of uranium to the U.S. are the countries of Russia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan, making up 50% of imports. Now, every pound of uranium that leaves Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan before it reaches the U.S. has to go through the Port of Petersburg in Russia, and furthermore, to go through conversion and enrichment services. So my view, even 18 years ago as an entrepreneur, was recognizing that jurisdictions like South Texas and Wyoming that were very much underexplored and were home to the beginning, I mean, the birthplace of in-situ recovery uranium mining that the Kazakhstan company Kazatomprom has utilized to become the world's largest uranium producer. This method of mining was invented and developed in South Texas and Wyoming, that these jurisdictions were very much underexplored, and that this was the opportunity that UEC, Uranium Energy Corp, really developed its business plan around from the very beginning, as you know. And I think fast forwarding to today, it's amazing to me that it's taken so long to recognize the national security and energy security issues around so much dependency on foreign uranium. And I think when you look at where the opportunities really lie in the U.S. is in the fact that the U.S. does have deposits and geologic settings that are amenable to the very low-cost way of mining uranium, again, called in-situ recovery. So we've had this plan, this vision, the strategy, Rick, as you know, you were there as a very early backer and supporter of this company going back 18 years ago. That's how long we've been at it in terms of assembling assets and in fact, becoming a producer in the U.S. We commenced production in 2010. And of course, those production plans were affected negatively due to what happened in the uranium market in 2011 and subsequent bear market that we had. But we've truly embraced the bear market opportunity to grow our company, making 10 cents on the dollar type of acquisitions, making more acquisitions of U.S.-based and Canadian projects and projects that we've acquired in South America. Obviously, our bread and butter is the U.S. and our in-situ recovery portfolio, which was really transformed last year with our latest acquisition, which was the all-cash acquisition of U1 from the Russian government. And that acquisition closed at the end of 2021. Really was a traditional and very well-timed acquisition. Uranium One arguably was and is the largest uranium company in the U.S., but was owned by the Russian government, by Rosatom, their state nuclear energy company. And by putting our money where our mouth is, making a big investment and acquiring those assets, really our intent is to demonstrate leadership in the U.S. uranium industry, and the Uranium One acquisition does that. Ironically, that acquisition is in fact the largest M&A deal in the sector, Rick, in the last decade. So it goes to show you how quiet the sector has been and that we're really seeing a transformational change here with the uranium price up. And with UEC being the largest and leading American uranium company, it could not have been better. But this didn't happen overnight. This is 18 years in the making.
So let's talk about those assets, the Wyoming assets and the Texas assets. Let's talk about the fact that they are both capable of production. What do you think the incentive price needs to be in order for Texas and Wyoming, respectively, to be brought back online by UEC? And how long would it take you once we assumed, once we hit, pardon me, those price targets for you to resume your status as a producer?
Well, for you, in looking at the fact that $50 was the incentive price to resume production, except in the last year, we've seen record inflation, record tight labor market, and supply chain bottlenecks as a result of COVID. I think for the most part, most of the industry's view on $50 being this magic price to restart production is somewhat dated, and it's not really adjusted for both COVID-related supply chain issues and the incredible inflation that we see out there in terms of inflationary pressures. Today, I believe the incentive price is probably closer to $55 to $60. Obviously, we're still within that range. And I think the other point here, Rick, is that incentive price is a function of both your expected operating costs, but also your upfront capital requirements and the kind of returns you need to secure to justify those upfront capital requirements. In the case of UEC, majority of the assets that we own, including the ones we acquired from Uranium One, including an operational processing plant, these assets are already built. We're shielded to a great extent from the tightness in the market in terms of supply chain issues and materials and inflation, because if you have two fully built processing plants as we do, and some immediate production capability that's already built, in the case of Uranium One, courtesy of Russia, we're certainly shielded from the capital requirements and the significant capex that is associated if you were to go build a brand new mine, and especially a conventional mine. The in-situ recovery projects are lower capital intensity. We're talking tens of dollars, not hundreds of millions of dollars. And I really think moving forward, that incentive price, Rick, is going to be north of 60. And frankly, when you think about where the price was pre, that's where contracts were happening. That's where utilities were signing many long-term contracts, was around $70 per pound over a decade ago. And that's more or less a price where I think buyers and sellers will end up feeling satisfied as a level to perhaps even sign more long-term contracts. Currently, we're permitted for 6.5 million pounds of annual production between our Texas and Wyoming processing plants and mines that are fully permitted. 8 fully permitted mines, 2 fully built processing plants, 6.5 million pounds of annual production capability, fully licensed with in-situ recovery in Texas and Wyoming.
So if, and tell me if I'm not interpreting what you just said correctly, I think what you're suggesting is that the incentive price to the rest of the industry that has to build plants is in the $70 range, but you suspect that you're economic at prices that are below that. So the sort of arbitrage between that and here accrues to your benefit. And you presuppose the second question, which is to say you're permitted for 6.5 million pounds. Do you see upside in that number? Do you see the ability to, either through exploration or development, increase your potential production in the U.S.?
100%. First of all, we already have plans underway to double our production capabilities from a licensing point of view. And from a licensing point of view, we benefit from the fact that both Texas and Wyoming are agreement states, whereby permitting happens at the state level only, and we don't have any federal oversight, and we don't have to seek permits from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the federal level. We also have over 100,000 acres of land with historic data in Wyoming, close to 1,000 acres in Texas, with, again, historic drilling. These are areas that are completely underexplored. We have spent very little, in fact, the industry has spent very little, looking for new uranium deposits in the United States using modern exploration techniques and tools. There's been very little done in the U.S. in terms of grassroots exploration over the last decade. I would even argue over the last 20 years. The focus has been primarily on brownfield projects. Look at this major success that we've seen companies have in West Athabasca Basin over the last decade by applying new modern exploration tools and techniques and concepts to look for new generation of uranium deposits. The U.S. not only lacks that, but has various confirmations from sources like the U.S. Geological Survey that truly demonstrates and shows how underexplored South Texas uranium belt is, how underexplored still parts of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming are. So we really believe that not only is the 6.5 million pounds a wonderful and baseline of annual production that UEC can demonstrate, but that there's substantial room for growth above and beyond that, whether from a permitting point of view, ability to upsize the processing capacity of our plants, existing plants, and through exploration drilling and decades of historic exploration we have to help de-risk our exploration, and by focusing on areas that, again, have not seen modern exploration and capital deployment and exploration for a long time.
A final question, Amir. If we assume that the overviews by WMC and by John Champaglia are correct, and that we are well on the way to broaching that $60 number, how much capital do you need to resume production at the 6.5 million pound a year level? How much capital do you have, and where will you get the balance?
So, Rick, I believe most of the capital we're going to need to realize the growth that we have in front of us to ramp up to 6.5 million pounds per year and then double from there is in fact embedded in a very interesting portfolio of physical uranium we assembled about a year ago. About a year ago, we entered the market, the physical market, and started purchasing physical uranium at $27 per pound to establish our physical uranium initiative and now program. This was with the view that we felt the uranium price was simply below the industry cost to mine it, below our own cost to mine it. Evaluation was reflecting a much higher price than where the spot price was trading at. And we knew we can also lock in long-term contracts, not to buy uranium, but to, sorry, not to sell uranium, but to buy uranium at those low environment that we saw a year ago. And so the company today has 4.5 million pounds of physical uranium that we've contracted for, some of which about 1.6 million we've taken delivery of, at an average cost of $35 per pound. At today's $55 uranium price, there's an unrealized gain of $90 million, 90, just in our physical program. And I suspect that that is more than in terms of where the future capital requirements will be for this company to grow. But besides the unrealized gain we have in our physical uranium program, we just this quarterly, and in our latest quarterly, we show that the $125 million of liquidity, that's cash, physical uranium on our balance sheet, and equity holdings that we have, 18% ownership in Uranium Royalty Corp. We have no debt. So $125 million of cash, $90 million in unrealized gains in our physical portfolio. This company has over $200 million of either immediate liquidity or plus unrealized gains. And again, a debt-free situation that we're in. And Rick, last but not least, 100% unhedged company. And I think that's a really important differentiator to really highlight here as well. The fact that historically, the big producers or companies with production capability, namely Cameco, have fully contracted and continue to contract, where in Cameco's latest results, for example, realized prices that they received for the quarter were around $43 per pound. What UEC has done from the beginning is not only to have a strong balance sheet, be debt-free, but to be 100% unhedged and use the flexibility with fully built in-situ recovery projects that are not as intensive as conventional mining to capture the movement and those violent movements we think there might be in the uranium price, to be able to fully capture that and let our investors be truly exposed to the market and the very bright future that we all see for uranium price.
Amir, thank you very much. I'm going to move on to your colleagues, Scott Milby, but stand by for the panel discussion, which you'll be a participant in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great work. And as Rick mentions, our next guest is Amir's close colleague, Scott Milby. He's the CEO of Uranium Royalty Corp. Good to see you, Scott. Rick, take it away.
Scott, delighted to have you with us.
Great, Rick. It's great to be here and be with thousands of really passionate uranium investors, and we're getting a full meal deal of uranium information at a pretty exciting point in the uranium commodity cycle.
Yeah, it's sort of fun after all those years that we spent together in the wilderness when most people couldn't spell uranium to have 3,100 investors worldwide joining in on a web-hosted conference about uranium. So let's give them the running's worth, Scott. Give us an overview of Uranium Royalty. Tell us, obviously, the uranium business is suddenly popular, and the royalty business has been popular for some point in time. Give us an overview of what you've done in the royalty space around uranium.
Yeah, well, it's very exciting to be part of what has been the one and only uranium royalty and streaming company in the space. We launched publicly on the TSX at December of 2019. We got our NASDAQ listing about this time last year, and it's really been a wonderful journey. And in terms of all the investments that have presented, we're a little bit of combination of all of them, frankly. You've got the straight uranium equity investments. You've got physical uranium investments like Yellowcake or Sput. You've got ETFs like URNM or URA. Well, the Uranium Royalty and Streaming Company kind of presents aspects of all of those, and that we don't own the uranium mining assets or developments. We don't have the big workforce, the big overhead. But what we do have are investments in the form of royalties and streams on those development projects and mines. So through their success, we generate cash flow from those royalties and streams, and our shareholders benefit from that exposure. So we're using our decades of uranium experience to look at the whole universe of potential developers, miners, and pick the winners from the rest of the group to try to put in our portfolio and really turbocharge that exposure for our investors.
Understanding that you're a fairly new company with lots of room to grow, could you tell us something about your existing assets?
Yeah, so for a relatively young company, we're off to a great start. We currently have 15 royalties in our portfolio, including two of the largest mines in the world and most highest grade largest mines in the world in Saskatchewan at Cigar Lake and MacArthur River. We have exposure throughout the U.S. through ISR exposure and some conventional exposure. Certainly, we're a global platform, and so we have royalty interests in Langer Heinrich, which is a proven producer who will restart under improved economics in the coming months and years. So we've started off to a great start, but we also have a very significant holding in physical uranium. Very early on, we took a foundational investment in Yellowcake, PLC out of London. That also gave us strategic, not only did it expose us to about $21 uranium in our portfolio at the time, but it also gave us strategic access to their long-term contract with Kazatomprom in Kazakhstan. And I can get in a little bit more into the physical uranium holdings, but it's really been an opportune time for us to buy uranium at the bottom of the cycle.
And perhaps you could take our investors through the difference from your point of view between uranium royalty and a uranium stream, and talk about whether the stream investments that you'll make are in byproduct uranium or primary uranium. Tell us something about the strategy, both in uranium royalties and in uranium streaming.
Yeah, so with both uranium royalties and uranium streams, we have to recognize that these are alternative forms of mine development finance. And I think in precious metals, it's become a $6 billion industry. I think royalties and streams are no longer alternative finance. They're a go-to lowest cost of capital for new mine development. But in terms of a royalty, it involves in new royalties that we might establish with a developer, it would have us providing upfront capital to bring their mine into production, develop a well field, develop their final feasibility studies, anything that would cause that mine to go towards production. And then in the future, we would receive financial royalties based on the value, usually in the form of revenue, top line revenue. You have some profit interest, but top line revenue obviously has its advantages. With streaming, we're doing the same thing, but we're taking a physical stream of the production down the road. And for us, and for me in particular, who spent 37 years in the uranium industry, the thought of taking physical uranium and holding that in our account at Cameco's facility in Ontario, Canada, is quite appealing. We can hold that asset along with the other 1.4 million pounds of uranium that we currently hold in the mix and add to that inventory, or we could realize on that by actually being sellers in the spot, medium or long-term contracts. However, we can maximize the value of that inventory investment.
Amir, your colleague, did a good job before you of talking about the embedded value in uranium energy with regards to your existing uranium holdings. Perhaps you could talk about that same attribute within uranium royalty.
Yeah, it's one of the beauties of uranium royalty investment is we have the entire upside of the uranium market upside, but also when we enter into a royalty or stream with a developer or miner, we also get the upside of further exploration discovery additional mine production over what was the project might have been originally valued at. So again, we think the name of the game for us is to provide investors exposure to the uranium story. So so far that's been through physical uranium holdings and royalties and streams. And I can tell you, 2021 was extremely busy, but 2022 we're already engaged in seven active files on deals that really run the gamut in terms of size of investment. But I think there's billions of dollars of investment needed. I think John from Sprott gave a good slide on that. There's probably 8 to 10 mines that need to be developed globally, over and above Kazatomprom producing at full capacity, over and above Cameco at full output in Saskatchewan. We need new mines in Australia, Africa, the United States, Canada, and our company wants to be the counterparty in their success and help them get into production.
And remind us how many existing pounds in inventory, direct or indirect, you have, and what's your average cost of those pounds?
Yes, so we to date have just 0.4 million pounds of U308 stored at Cameco's facility. The acquisition cost on that was $39 per pound. So I think in Canadian dollars, the gain on that is already 29 million Canadian dollars. So in addition to that, in 2021, we entered into a supply stream with CGN, the Chinese global uranium mining entity that has the Husab mine in Namibia, and we have deliveries coming under that contract through 2025, an average price of $47 a pound. So definitely giving early shareholders until we get to more steady, we start to see steady state cash flows from our royalties. The gain on uranium investments has been quite significant already in the early years.
And would you suggest, or is it too early to tell, whether the bulk of your deployments will be royalty deployments or streaming deployments? Is that too early to tell?
Well, the files that we have active right now, I can say we're looking at the acquisition of existing royalties that already exist, and we're providing essentially a secondary market for the seller to realize value on that. But we're also looking at financing both future developments with sizable royalty deals, but also looking at streaming deals with producers that would be more in the byproduct realm. And we can really come along and provide uranium expertise and value to the uranium stream, which might not be their main focus or interest.
Follow-on question, including the liquidity that you have in your physical uranium, the first part of the question is, how much liquidity do you have on the balance sheet now to pursue transactions? And then the second question would be, in terms of liquidity additions, traditionally royalty and streaming companies have, because of the stability of their cash flows, been able to utilize modest leverage. Leverage to capture the sort of equity premium to their benefit. Do you have access to capital, including debt capital?
Yeah, so we've only entered into one debt facility with Bank of Montreal, which is, I think, more of a bridge financing to be able to take advantage of quick opportunities and uranium purchases or deals. But we already have a very significant cash and equity holdings in physical uranium that total $113 million. So smaller acquisitions we can fund from our own balance sheet. If we looked at much larger, we would obviously look to private placement or placement of additional shares or utilize the ATM financing. It's important to note that when we go to the equity markets and we raise capital that way, almost 100% of that dollars raised go into accretive acquisitions, because the overhead on a company which can be run with 4 or 5 employees, we could double, triple in size with that staff and G&A, which I think last year was only $1 million to maintain this company. All the equity raised is going to go to accretive acquisitions, and the company will really be re-rated with each acquisition. And that's really an important point. Don't look at this company by the 15 royalties that we presently have in the portfolio. That's just the beginning. This is a growth platform, and as I mentioned, you know, we hope to be adding a number of royalties and streams every year to really grow this into we're presently a $500 million company, but you know, if we're not a $1 billion company within the next couple 3 years, we're not executing on our plans.
Scott, it's a wonderful story. It's been a tremendous decade that we've enjoyed together. Thank you so much for your contribution on behalf of early shareholders like myself. And thank you, too, for your participation in the Uranium Boot Camp. Please stand by for the panel.
Excellent. Thanks, Rick.
All right. Like Rick said, don't go anywhere, because at this time, we're going to welcome back Amir Adnani of UEC and invite Duncan Crabb, CEO of Boss Energy, to join Rick on the panel. Rick, back to you.
Gentlemen, welcome. I'm delighted to have all of you with us. And just for fun, rather than beginning the panel on an up note, I'm going to begin the panel on a down note. I'm going to ask each of you, what could go wrong? What could go wrong with the uranium thesis? We heard from WMC about a whole bunch of things that could go right. We heard from John Champaglia about a whole bunch of things that could go right. What keeps you awake, not so much with regards to your company, I'll ask you that question later, what keeps you awake at night with regards to the uranium market, given that I think I see Duncan? We'll begin the question with him.
What keeps me awake in the market? I guess, look, I'm hugely optimistic, Rick, and before I start, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. But really, I see new technology. I see that we've gone from the periods of sort of driving almost T-model Ford type nuclear power plant technology to this much more advanced, more modular reactors and you know, almost Tesla-driven type. So I'm hugely optimistic. The dangers are really political uncertainty. We've seen that more recently in Russia, Ukraine, and the unfortunate incident there. And I think that that really highlights the need for really providing good safeguards to the industry. Looking at producers that are in sort of political and economic stable countries that can produce. So I think what keeps me awake at night is really just the overall sustainability of the industry, looking at how we can move forward. I personally, I see nuclear as part of any country's energy mix. I'm not saying it's the be all or end all, but I certainly think that we've got a responsibility in decarbonizing the world, and nuclear's got a role to play alongside other renewable forms of energy.
Amir, I'm going to ask you the same question. What keeps you awake at night with regards to the uranium market? You're an expert at what could go right. What could go wrong?
Well, I don't want to repeat the points that Duncan mentioned, which I agree with and echo, just to try to add some new thoughts and ideas to that. I mean, I think before we kind of talk about what can go wrong, we need to, you know, fully understand that this is a highly easy to understand marketplace in terms of supply demand, that once you have a nuclear reactor built and there's over 50 under construction right now and hundreds being planned for future development, these are reliable customers and consumers of uranium for the next 50 to 60 years, maybe even longer. So extremely long dated demand and long dated energy capacity. Maybe Japan still keeps me up at night. Maybe I kind of wonder about how fast we can see an acceleration or restarts in Japan in terms of reactor restarts. It makes all the sense in the world that both for political reasons and energy security reasons also in that country, that hopefully we can see an accelerated path to reactor restarts there, because that then signals that there's even less available above ground inventories or secondary supplies that can enter the market. I worry still that the TEPCOs of the world and other sources of Japanese inventory at a high uranium price environment may be tempted to continue to divest of their uranium holdings. But if we see a turnaround and acceleration restarts, that risk might go away. I don't think it's something that couldn't be absorbed with the current liquidity in the market, but Japan, I think, still remains a concern in my mind.
Scott, now that you're prepared to answer the black swan question, I'm going to ask you a white swan question. We always look at what could go wrong, what could surprise us on the downside. What could surprise us on the upside? What could cause uranium to overshoot in this bull cycle as much as it overshot in the last bull cycle? What could go right in the uranium business?
Well, I think that's the accurate question. I tend to look at this bull market compared to the last bull market in uranium that Rick, you and I enjoyed and made a lot of money for our shareholders in the process. But you know, back then, we still had half the world against nuclear energy. We had the political left violently opposed to us. Environmentalists hadn't warmed up to the green nuclear power, and even the institutional investors weren't fully on board with uranium. This go around, we have not only positive supply and demand fundamentals of just production, inventory, and consumption, but we have megatrends. We have the nuclear playing a major role in the green energy and decarbonization of our energy economy. We have the inventory kind of black swan that came in, and I don't call them a catalyst, I call them a tipping point, is Sprott. I mean, we were going to get to where we're going to be without Sprott, but it just, their entrance allowed that to happen sooner, vacuum up those excess pounds, and get us back to a rebalanced uranium, I think, we're in today. So, where I think we're underestimating in the supply and demand at this point is on the demand side. Only very recently have we started to talk seriously about small modular and advanced reactors. These are not the 1600 megawatt reactors that we're used to and are still coming online. We've had 62 of them come online in the last 8 years, but these are the 50, 100, 200, 300 megawatt scalable reactors that are built in factory, shipped on site. They have a quicker payback, a lower capital investment. They can coexist on grids that are heavily burdened by intermittent renewables, and they can also be part of remote locations in remote communities, island nations, mining operations. I think we've only touched the surface of the application of these small modular micro reactors and what a big market that's going to be going forward. So when we talk about uranium demand at 180 to 200 million pounds a year present, I think we're going to be revising that probably every quarter here going forward. At 3.5% annual growth rate, it will be higher.
Duncan, we're going to talk to you later in the session about your assets in Australia, but let's talk about Australia and uranium generally. We're talking about the more favorable political winds around uranium. I know Australia traditionally has had a three mines policy, and one would suggest that Australia, like much of the world, hasn't necessarily been friendly territory for uranium. That seems to be changing. Am I reading, or put differently, is your reading of the political winds, first of all in Australia, but second of all globally, as sort of appealing as mine is?
It certainly is. And I think COP26 conference in Glasgow, the climate change conference, really highlighted that at the end of last year. Particularly in Australia, particularly with the younger generation accepting of new technology and nuclear, we're all concerned about the future. Decarbonisation is absolutely critical, and sort of weaning ourselves off some of the historical sort of fossil fuels. So nuclear does have a role to play. In Australia, we need bipartisan political support. We need the main political parties to agree to this. And we're not there yet, but certainly the conversations are being had, which is particularly pleasing. When you look at Australia as a world's resource for uranium, we hold approximately one third of the world's resource of uranium, but we're only exporting 7.6% of the world's demand. So there's a wonderful opportunity within Australia to really capitalise on this. And also for those sort of fossil fuel, coal, etc., that we're weaning ourselves off, that labour skill can migrate into the uranium industry. So there's fantastic opportunity here. South Australia, where our mine Honeymoon is based, is the premier uranium state. You've got BHP's Olympic Dam, you've got Heathgate operation. So it's slowly expanding, and around the nation, there's a lot of exploration activity going on. So.